Blog Talk Radio.
Cowards try to change our lives, change the things they despise in America. But heroes, fueled by freedom, that unalienable right to be, came to rescue the injured, rescue the innocent, rescue these truths we hold to be. Self-evident. And down by the Creator, they went down into that crater, in that fiery hell, they sacrificed their lives. Steel and stone, sweat and heartache. Now it stands once again for freedom. So call it freedom. Call it freedom, call it freedom.
And a very good Saturday afternoon to you. Jason Hawes here on American Faith Today, back on the normal schedule for the show, and it's good to be back on a normal schedule after a couple of kind of off-kilter, off-schedule weekends in a row. On last weekend, when I did a show on Sunday, due to the fact that I went to my friend's wedding on the previous Saturday, and also did a show on Monday, 4th of July, and the previous weekend doing a show on Sunday, when I also had to work on the previous Saturday. So I'm back on schedule anyway, and like I said, that's a good thing for me. I can say that with doing a couple of shows on Sunday, and this is just a thought, this is not anything that is a definite thing that I am going to do, but I am kind of mulling around in my brain a little bit the idea of doing a show on Sunday as well, because there's have people honking their horns for no reason outside my window. But anyway, I think they were honking at each other, so hopefully they were happy with each other. I don't know. But anyway, I am kind of considering doing a show, an additional show on Sundays. Like I said, it's just a thought. It's not anything I've completely decided, but with all the information that I do have available to look up stories when I'm doing a news story-based show, particularly if it's a political show, there's all sorts of political news stories, of course, at all times. And I could even do something that would be a continuation, as I did this past Sunday and Monday when I did a two-part show. So I don't know if I'm going to do that or not. Like I said, it hasn't been completely decided in my own mind, but I'm probably leaning in that direction. It's entirely doable, because even though I do work on Sundays, Sundays are so dead for us at our store that usually, even though technically I'm scheduled to be in there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, usually I'm headed home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, because we're just that dead on a Sunday afternoon at the store. So it may be something that happens, good chance, but like I said, nothing definite as of yet, just something I'm kind of mulling over. Today, July 9th, and I don't know, I guess I wanted to say this. I don't want to take a lot of time, because, again, time flies on this show with only 45 minutes to play around with. But July 9th has come to kind of have a entirely different meaning for me now, I guess, and I'll go as quickly as I can here. When I was, and I would say about third or fourth grade, we had a new kid come to our school named Sean. And Sean was somebody who took a liking to me right away, as well as a liking to one of my friends, Keith. And we also had another friend, kind of what I would call in the group, because he was my best friend growing up. Back then known as E.G., as he's become an adult, he simply goes by Ed. But anyway, we had a new kid show up in school named Sean. Like I said, when I was in about third grade, which would have been ages ago, third grade, I was 8 years old, so probably about 32 years ago. Sean's birthday was today, July 9th, 1976, was his actual date of birth, exactly 1 week after my date of birth, July 2nd, 1976. So his birthday was always easy to remember. And like I said, we became friends and were friends for a few years, for several years, probably by about 8th and 9th, 10th grade for me, somewhere in there. Things started to change with Sean, and he changed. And in my opinion back then, not necessarily for the better. I don't know if he was going through problems at home, which a lot of times kids that age do. I don't know if he was having problems at school. I know when Keith and I and basically everyone else left sixth grade and left elementary school and moved on to seventh grade and junior high, Sean was held back that year. And I don't know if that started something for him, that he didn't, you know, go to junior high with us. I have no idea, obviously. But the relationship and the friendship changed a bit. And there was one time in particular in which Sean and Keith and another kid that we knew, Nathan, came to my house on their bikes. We were looking at and trading baseball cards, sports cards, and things of that sort. And I knew that Sean and Nathan did not get along. Keith would tell me that they would actually steal cards from each other. And I saw Sean looking at some of my, and again, this was many years ago, looking at some of my more valuable cards, none of which were super valuable, but they were my more valuable baseball, football cards, things of that sort. And he was looking at them, he had them in his lap, and he kind of almost with his body language was trying to make it hidden that he was even looking at them. But I didn't say anything. He wasn't stuffing them in his pockets or putting them in his bag or anything, but sure enough, the cards wound up missing. The cards were stolen. When they left, I put my cards up and looked for those cards in particular, and they were stolen. And I went out, and I'm about probably 13, 14 years old at this point, around a freshman in high school. I went out, I told my mom, my dad was working, of course, and I went out, I told my mom, and I guess almost in tears, as I remember, and as I recall my mom making a point of, because you know, you have friends, whether you have problems with them or not, you have friends that you invite into your home and they steal from you. You definitely feel violated. Keith's mom actually wound up being the big hero, and we went through my dad and I talking to both Sean and Nathan, who Sean blamed for it. Keith's mom actually wound up being the big hero, saying, we don't really care who stole Jason's cards. You know, we don't have to know. Just leave them at our door, leave them at our porch, and that'll be as far as it goes. And, you know, if you don't do that, we may have to get the sheriff involved. And I got my cards back, long story short. And there is a point to this, by the way, which I'll get to, but that pretty much ended the friendship with Sean, unfortunately, and I didn't try to hold it against him, but it just did. And we eventually, in a couple years, we were all driving to school, no longer riding the school bus, same bus and everything, and kind of went our separate ways. I did see Sean when I was in college and coming through the drive-thru at the Taco Bell here in town, and I saw him at the drive-thru window a couple times, and he either didn't recognize me or didn't want to say anything to me. Seemed absolutely miserable. And, you know, I really wondered at that point what was going on with him. Well, fast forward years later, and through the magic of Facebook, we reconnected. And I had posted something on the Facebook page of a mutual friend. Sean saw it, sent me a message asking if I was that particular Jason Hawes, and I said, well, yes, I am. He sent me a friend request, and I accepted it because what happened years ago was years ago. And, you know, we didn't become best buddies or anything like that, but we had a, you know, a good online Facebook friend relationship. He actually liked the Facebook page for American Faith Today. I don't know if he ever caught the show or not. I never asked him, but he actually, you know, things were good between us. And the point to all this is last year, I got this message from, again, my best friend as a kid growing up, E.G., or now Ed, I believe last August, sent me a message, private message on Facebook, asking if I had heard about Sean Hill. And I said no, and I'm thinking this probably isn't going to be good, because whenever somebody asks you a question like that, usually the person has died or is sick or in some kind of trouble. And, of course, then he follows up by sending me the obituary for Sean Hill. He was killed, again, last year, last August, in a motorcycle accident in which, from reading some of the details, he hit the back of a semi, was killed instantly, and it seems like the semi, the truck driver, did not stop at a stop sign. And not only did he not stop at the stop sign, but he then drove. I don't think Sean was underneath the semi, but his motorcycle was. He drove another 8 miles with the semi literally lodged under, or with the motorcycle literally lodged under his semi. He was cited for vehicular manslaughter or vehicular homicide and leaving the scene of an accident. That's a case that I believe is going to be finalized perhaps next month, it looked like. I was just checking it on the Shelby County, Ohio court website. But, you know, I just, like I said, this would have been his 40th birthday. And even when I wasn't really friends with him anymore and really hadn't talked to him in several years because of life taking us different places, I'd always remembered, well, you know, July 9th, this is Sean's birthday. And like I said, he should ideally be celebrating his 40th birthday today. Unfortunately, he is not. But it's kind of funny and kind of cool that his Facebook page is still active. I think it's kept active by his brother. People there, including myself, wished him birthday greetings and some sort. And, you know, I certainly, the problems that we had as kids, I certainly don't use that to try to make him look bad in any sense. But just to give you an idea of kind of the ups and downs of our knowing each other and relationship, and it does serve as a reminder how fleeting and how fragile life is. And you know, it's too short, certainly, to hold grudges. It's too short to not forgive people. It's too short to let anger and hostility and anything else fester and continue for a long period of time, especially if it's family, if it's friends, what have you. And he does, unfortunately, leave behind, if I remember correctly, and has left behind, if I remember correctly, a daughter. He was not married. I don't know if he'd been married in the past or was just in a relationship, but he leaves behind, I believe, one daughter. And certainly for those of you out there who are Christian, it would be a good thing. And I would encourage you and ask you to send some prayers the way of his family and his friends, because I'm sure on days like this, even though everybody's got their brave face and their, you know, life goes on face and attitude, I'm sure it's tough for family in particular whenever a birthday comes up or an anniversary or what have you. So, again, some of you, if you could be so kind to send some prayers for his family, and his friends. That would be super. But I wanted to get back into the Bible today. And I wanted to talk a little bit. This is something that kind of came to mind as I was doing my own Bible study. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some types of Antichrist in the Old Testament in particular. Now, there are, I believe, many types of Antichrist in the Old Testament and in the Bible. And there are, what I believe, many types of Antichrist that we see with our political leaders, presidents, and presidential candidates today. And, you know, there are many people, when you look at the Old Testament in particular, that would say, oh, well, that's the Old Testament. You know, that's nothing but a bunch of history. It doesn't apply today. Well, you then will have never have read, apparently, and there's some in the Old Testament that is history, but there's also some in the New Testament that is prophecy yet to come. But as Solomon wrote, in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 9, when he wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not reading it here in front of me, but basically he wrote, that which has been shall be again, and there's no new thing under the sun. And also you have in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, and that I believe the 11th verse, in which Paul writes that these things that happened in the past are examples or in samples for our admonition, for our, you know, kind of something for us to learn from and to be aware of, upon which the ends of the world have come or will come, which we are in that last fig tree generation. So it is important to keep an eye on history and to keep an eye on types. And, you know, one of the greatest examples that I have ever seen anybody lay out was from the late Pastor Arnold Murray from Shepherd's Chapel, who brought up, if you go into the book of Daniel, I'm not going to go there right now, but if you go into the book of Daniel, the fourth chapter, where you have Nebuchadnezzar who loses his kingdom for a period of time, and it was prophesied by Daniel, by God through Daniel, regarding interpretation of a dream Nebuchadnezzar had, that this would happen. And Nebuchadnezzar lost his kingdom. He had seven times, however he wanted to measure a time or however long a period of actual time that wound up being, but he had seven times pass over him until he repented and his kingdom was restored to him. And during that time, he basically lived and acted as an animal. You know, his hair and his nails all grew out. Well, when Saddam Hussein was toppled, if you will, literally toppled even, if you can remember the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down, when our troops and troops of other nations basically ended his reign, and again, you perhaps remember that statue of him literally being shoved down, well, 7 months after the fact, or seven times, if you will, we find, Saddam Hussein hiding out in a hole in the desert, and they bring him up, and he looked like a mess. His hair was all matted and unkempt. His nails, his fingernails were long, and again, as described to as Nebuchadnezzar, where his hair would be as bird's feathers, his nails would be as bird's talons or claws, and that's exactly the image that Saddam Hussein gave 7 months after losing, or seven times after losing power in Iraq. So, again, God's word is true. That which has been will be again. That which was a type is something that, in one way, will be repeated once again. And then you have many people who say, well, the Antichrist, this kind of stuff is good to know, perhaps, on an intellectual level, but I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be raptured out of here. And certainly there's going to be people who disagree with me when I say this, but in my reading and in my interpretation and in also how I've been taught, but also how I interpret and how I, you know, what I see as truth in the Bible, you're not going to be gone. None of us will be. Many people point to the rapture as being based on 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17 primarily, but then I would ask, have you never read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where Paul wrote explicitly that do not be deceived by any man, by any teaching, by any spirit, by the letter that we wrote to you before regarding the return of Christ, the Lord's day, and regarding our gathering back to him, that could happen at any moment, basically, because things must happen first, including a falling away, an apostasy, and the Antichrist himself showing up and sitting in the temple claiming to be God and showing himself and trying to convince other people that he is God, many of which, unfortunately, will be convinced, most of the world. But we're going to be here for that. So it's very important to keep an eye on different types of Antichrist, how they operated, what was particular about them, and can we take a look at them and apply it perhaps to the Antichrist that is still to come, the Antichrist. I want to go to Genesis chapter 10, and I'll be skipping around a bit. I won't be going probably as in-depth as I would maybe like to for time's sake, but Genesis chapter 10, I wanted to go here. We're going to deal with Nimrod, and we're going to deal with the Tower of Babel. And I want to go with Genesis chapter 10, verse 8, and it reads, "And Cush begat Nimrod." Cush, which was a son of Ham, and Ham, which was a son of Noah. So basically, Nimrod would have been a great-grandson of Noah. "And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth." Now, this word Nimrod comes from the Hebrew word marad, and it literally means to rebel. And when given in the first person plural, and I'm reading also some notes here from theseason.org, Roger Christofferson and his commentary, when given in the first person plural, it reads Joseph, meaning we will rebel. And there's also a note here from Christofferson that includes the writings of Josephus in his Antiquities, that he wrote, "Nimrod persuaded mankind not to ascribe their happiness to God, but to think that his own excellency was the source of it, taking the place of God with his person and with his governmental system. And soon he changed things into a tyranny, thinking there was no other way to wean men from the fear of God than by making them rely upon his own power." And there's a lot of extemporaneous or outside writings and sources regarding Nimrod. You can find references that Nimrod and his mother portrayed themselves and were portrayed as gods themselves. In 1 Chronicles chapter 10, or excuse me, 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 10, Nimrod again is mentioned. Apparently, there is a Chaldee translation of 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 10, and the reference to Nimrod, in which it seems to point out that Nimrod spilled innocent blood against God, and there are people who believe that those who did believe in God, those who stood for God, those who were servants of God, that Nimrod killed to try to prove his power. And that even lines up a little bit with the writings of Josephus in his Antiquities. Verse 9 of Genesis chapter 10. "He was a mighty hunter before the Lord," and actually this "before the Lord" could be translated "in defiance of God. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before the Lord," or "the mighty hunter in defiance of God." And also it's a reference here that there was a Semitic proverb that took its origin in belief that, written here, Jehovah, real name Yahweh, but Jehovah was not known in Babylonia. In other words, they completely kicked him out. They completely booted him out, so to speak. Again, sounds very much like what's going on today. Certainly, if you have eyes to see, ears to hear, they tried to replace God with man's governmental system, and they try to make some man, in this case Nimrod, a type of antichrist, to take the place of God. Again, Genesis 10:10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, or Babylon, or confusion, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calna, in the land of Shinar, which basically is located where our Iraq is located today. But anyway, here you have this great-grandson of Noah, who should have known better, without a doubt, but certainly if you read, as I was reading in my own studies recently, and as I'll be getting into in 2 Kings, you go down through the king line. The king line, unfortunately, of Israel was, with some exceptions, almost all wicked, and people who were into idolatry, encouraged idolatry, building their groves, their high places, burning their incense to Baal and whomever else. Many of the kings of Judah at various points were some were decent, some were far from decent, and you had in there, in that dynastic line, you had where you may have had a father who was quite wicked, and then a son who was good, or a grandson, or a great-grandson who was good. You may have had 2-3 generations in which things were going wrong, and then all of a sudden, a righteous king shows up, be it Hezekiah, be it Josiah, be it whomever. And then you had your wicked kings as well, such as Manasseh. But anyway, it's somewhat interesting that in families, you would have these, some of whom were quite good and some of whom were quite evil. Nimrod, of course, wound up being quite evil. I want to go to Genesis chapter 11 and just get a little bit into the Tower of Babel. 11:1, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. One worldism. You know, bring everybody together under one governmental body. In this case, this would have been Nimrod's governmental body, and there are scholars and commentators who point out that man's first attempt at a one-world system was Nimrod's attempt with his government in the Tower of Babel. Verse 2, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. 3, and they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. Obviously, we know they're going to build or try to build the Tower of Babel here. Verse 4, and they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. We're going to work out our own salvation here. We're not going to rely on God to help us or save us. We're going to build up our own little system, so that, you know, we can take the place of God, so that we can rely on our own strength for our protection, for our salvation. And again, as it continues out, to be known, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And, of course, you can continue to read basically what happened. God literally, I believe, came down, and God and his angels, of course, confused their language, changed their language to where they could not understand one another. And that tower, of course, was not completed, and they were scattered despite their best plans. And I think what we can take out of this is, first of all, again, it's man coming together to try to put together some glorious, in his mind, one-world system, which we know is coming, which we know basically the framework of it already exists, be it the United Nations or be it what, you know, whatever they wind up using. But to try to come up with a one-world system in which all blessings, all privileges, all rights, you know, in this country, in the United States, our country was founded upon the fact that government does not grant rights, but God himself grants rights. And government's only duty in that aspect is to protect the natural, God-given, and in some cases, many cases, of course, the inalienable rights of all men. But, you know, you're going to have, and we are seeing it now, we will continue to see it, you're going to have people in this world try to put this system together that leaves out God, that ultimately brings in a fake God, a fake Messiah, Antichrist himself, Satan himself, to rule over this system, to run it as a political beast, and when he arrives, as a religious beast. But guess what? The good news is, it's not going to succeed in the long term, just like the Tower of Babel. And again, even that end times system, that end times one world system, Babylon, which has nothing to do with a location, but a spiritual state, which again means confusion. You're not going to be successful if your game plan, if your modus operandi is based upon confusion. God will destroy that at his time. And God will bring that down to nothing. Now, they're going to have their period of time, but in the end, it's going to fail, just as the Tower of Babel failed. But, you know, you do see this notion of trying to put a one-world system together, trying to replace God in people's hearts and minds, and to rely on, be it Antichrist, to be it on a human-made, man-made governmental system, and to look at that as God, more or less. We've been building up to that for some time, and I believe in not too far of a distant period of time, we're going to see it all come to pass, both the bad and ultimately the good. Now, I want to turn to 2 Kings chapter 18. I don't know if I'll even get to Nebuchadnezzar today. I want to turn to 2 Kings chapter 18, though, but I want to start with I don't know if I want to start there for time's sake. I'll start a few verses down. Basically, background here, the king of Assyria, who had taken the house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, captive and scattered them, now is making a move against the house of Judah and Benjamin. And ultimately, of course, it would not be the Assyrian king that took Judah captive. It would be Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. But he's coming, and at this point in 2 Kings chapter 18, against Judah. And Judah's king at that time, Hezekiah, who overall was a good king. He made his mistakes, but overall Hezekiah was a good king for Judah. I'll start with verse 19. Rabshakeh, who was a representative of the Assyrian king. And Rabshakeh said unto them, speak ye now to Hezekiah. And the Assyrian, of course, I'm saying, it is a type of Antichrist, by the way. Speak now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? And I could say, who will you put your faith in? Who will you put your trust in when that time comes in which the Antichrist is on the scene and at your door, spiritually speaking? Hopefully it's not going to be in some man. Hopefully it will be in God himself. But he says, who do you put your trust in? Verse 20, thou sayest, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for the war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? 21, now behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lead, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, unto all that trust on him. And it is thought, by the way, that the Assyrian actually wanted to go after Egypt primarily, and Judah and Jerusalem was just kind of a stepping stone to conquer on the way to Egypt. But again, he's saying you're putting your trust, or at least he thought that Hezekiah and that Judah was putting their trust in some other man who's not reliable, who's not trustworthy. Verse 22, but if ye say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah have taken away and have said to Judah and Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem. Well, Hezekiah took away the high places that were used for idolatry and other gods. Hezekiah, again, tried to clean up, and in a large sense did clean up what was going on in Judah. But this is where, again, this is where you want to obviously put your trust, is in God. 23, now therefore I pray thee, give pledges to my lord the king of Assyria, and I will deliver thee 2,000 horses if thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. He's even saying, he's mocking them a little bit, even saying, we'll even donate some of our army, some of our military equipment to you, if you're able to even muster up the forces to make use of it. 24, how then wilt thou turn away thy face of one captain of the least of my master's servants, and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? 25, am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. And this was true in a sense, to some degree. And Isaiah, who was a prophet at the time, had warned that this would be coming. Verse 26 then said, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joha, unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, to thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and talk not with us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. In other words, they did not want people becoming unsettled, becoming fearful, and buying into these threats. 27, but Rabshakeh said unto him, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men which sit on the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you? 28, then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language, obviously not caring what was said to him by these other three, and spake, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. 29, thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. 30, neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Well, you know, the Lord certainly can protect them, and ultimately, when they turn to him for protection, the Lord would protect them. But again, and this is how it continues on, and actually the next verse is very relevant. Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me, buy a present, and come out to me, and then eat ye every man of his own vine, and every one of his own fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his cistern. And again, this goes on for time's sake, unfortunately, I won't get into it, but the key thing here is, and, you know, I can envision this taking place. One of the ways I believe that the Antichrist is going to operate, he's going to offer you, me, any of us, all people, whatever it takes to get them over to his side. You know, he's going to offer you the good life. He's going to offer to give you any so-called blessing. Anything that you need, he's going to take care of you. You're going to live easy and carefree because I've come back to save you, to gather you back to me, to rapture you away. You know, I love you. You're my child. You're my bride. Just follow me. You know, follow me. Just whatever I have to do, just follow me. And at the same time, he's probably, you know, there's going to be people who don't follow him. And you probably will get a little bit of mockery and sarcasm because, look, it's going to be tough for us in the flesh. It is absolutely going to be tough. When it says, as it says in Revelation chapter 13, that no one could buy or sell unless they had, again, the mark of the beast, and unless they worshipped the Antichrist, they could not buy or sell. Well, you know, I think as I even consider it myself and extend it out, that's probably going to go further then simply you can't go and buy groceries. You know, again, I think I've said this before, but, you know, what happens when, again, you don't have the right currency, so to speak, and you're not aligned with the right individual, that being Satan, that being Antichrist, and, oh, well, you know what, actually, you're not able to buy electricity. So your electric bill is shut off. That's entirely possible, or your electric is shut off. That's entirely possible that that could happen. And you would have Satan, you would have Antichrist, you would have those in his camp saying, oh, look at who that person relies on. Look, that person claims to rely on God, and his God can't even turn on his electric for him. You're probably, it's quite possible you'll see things like that. Anything that he can do to shake up someone's faith, anything that he can do to buy someone over to his side. But again, guess what? Just as the Assyrian was turned away from Judah, thanks to the prayers of Hezekiah and the people, so too God will protect his own. God will watch out for his own. And as the Assyrian was not successful in that sense, in that case, Satan will not be successful in, hopefully, those of you who have eyes to see and ears to hear, and I trust that he won't, be successful in deceiving you or in making it all that hard for you. It will perhaps be difficult, but if you trust on God, you can make it through. You know, if you trust on him and use your own intuition and intellect, you'll get through just fine. And God will see to it. Now, I'll try to come here to the book of Daniel. Again, I'm not going to have a whole lot of time, unfortunately. But the book of Daniel, I reference this fairly often. In the book of Daniel, when you get into the... I'll just hit some high points here. But when you get into the book of Daniel, chapter 3, this is an occurrence. This was an event that if this can't lift your faith and God's ability to protect his own and to provide for his own, even against incredible obstacles and odds, then, you know, I could almost say, what's wrong with you, or what could? In Daniel chapter 3, again, I'll hit some high points. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And as we know, he wanted everyone to bow down to this image of gold when there were 6 different types of music that sounded. There were 6s all over this chapter. Again, an image that was 60, that's 60 cubits, and 60 cubits high, 6 cubits around, 6 cubits wide, 606, if you will. 6 types of music, so there's 6s all over this thing, over this image, and Nebuchadnezzar wanting people to bow down to it. And then you get down to the 3 Hebrew children who were renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That was not their Hebrew names, if you will. But you have them delivered up by the troublemakers in the Babylonian kingdom who are saying, they won't bow to your system, O king. They won't worship your statue. They won't listen to you. And you have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who we know are thrown into this fiery furnace, heated at 7 times hotter. And again, all I can say for time's sake is I hope that you're all familiar with this story. I trust that you are, and you can read it yourselves in Daniel chapter 3. Heated 7 times hotter, where even the people throwing them bound into the thing are killed by the heat from the flames of the furnace themselves. But Nebuchadnezzar, looking at these 3 Hebrew children bound in the flames, and sits up out of his chair and says, what? I'll read this, 24, then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonied and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God, because it was the Son of God. You know, everything that goes on during that time, during Satan's tribulation, like I said, it's going to be tough. And he's going to try to woo all of us, so to speak. He's going to try to, I think, mock those who won't come to his side.